Greetings, everyone. This is Christina Turin calling you from San Diego. I'm downtown off the mountain where they're having a snowstorm up on the mountain. So I am at a lovely hotel calling you from San Diego. This morning we had a very wonderful guest speaker by the name of Jeff Folk. And in a few minutes we're going to actually start listening to his conference call. It's very thought-provoking. A lot of people responded about how they finally get it, that everything is related, and what we can see through cymatics on the plates where they make these beautiful patterns, and then everything goes into total chaos, and then out of the chaos arises another beautiful pattern. And I hope that you have all had a chance to watch the videos and YouTube streams on this month's lesson. Before we begin, I'd like to just take a moment to relay some information that has come up recently that may affect quite a few of you. And this has to do with the ESM, Experiential Specialty Module. Now, in San Diego, we have been affiliated with the San Diego Hospice since 1997. And at one time, we were considered one of the three top teaching hospices in the world. And about 2 years ago, we became known as the top teaching hospice. It's been a wonderful place to work. However, there have been some changes that have taken place because of all the financial crisis with Medicare. And Medicare has been auditing hospices throughout the country. And as a result of that, San Diego Hospice served a lot of people at our hospice who were not able to pay. They did not have their own insurance, people that were homeless, and Medicare picked up the tab on that. Well, Medicare now is doing an audit, and San Diego Hospice decided that while the funds are cut off right now from Medicare in order to keep our doors open, that they're closing down for 6 months. And this may be something that other hospices and hospitals that depend on Medicare are experiencing throughout the country. It's not just San Diego Hospice. So what this has created is that on January 4th, the doors to San Diego Hospice will be closing. And they plan to be closed for 6 months. Now, Our availability for our ESM in May has now, well, there's nobody there. There's no kitchen crew. There's no custodial staff. It's closed. As you know, we have a new HARP center, a HARP chalet, and it will be able to hold comfortably about 15 people for the classes. It is 50 miles outside of San Diego, the city, up in the mountains. Around the corner, we have rustic cabins and motel. And actually, there are two-bedroom cabins where each person could have their own room, and then there's a pull-out trundle in the living room. And it actually turns out to be a lot more affordable than it would have been coming to San Diego and staying at one of the two hotels that we usually stay at. We're going to need a collection of people who can drive and rent cars and split that cost in order to make this successful. I can only put four people in the car, so we're going to need more cars. The other thing that happened that I want to relay to you is that old saying, when one door closes, another door opens. So there's a private hospice in San Diego, and they got in touch with me earlier this summer about wanting to affiliate with them. and they do not have a facility like San Diego Hospice has, but they serve patients within the community in the home and in skilled nursing facilities and in retirement homes. So the day that I went to San Diego Hospice and found out all the bad news was the same day that I had a meeting with Apraiva Hospice. And it turns out that it's actually going to be a wonderful experience because we'll be going to different facilities. And not only will we be at the bedside with hospice patients, but we'll also be able to implement interactive playing, working with groups of people, working with people with special needs, some of the people who have had strokes, and the people at Apraiva Hospice are just as lovely as the people at San Diego Hospice. So at this point, I'm going to ask for a show of hands, and I'm going to ask you who is planning to come to San Diego in May. And the first question will be, if you're planning to come to San Diego in May, then I would ask you to do press number one. And if you were planning to do your internship, press number two. So only press two if you were going to come to San Diego to do internship and the ESM, and only press number one if you were going to do just the ESM. So if you could do that for me, and then I will call out the names in case somebody's ability to press the button didn't come through. And while that information is coming in, I'm going to also mention that I'm talking with Bambi Niles, and we're hoping to put together the ESM, planning on it, and a conference in Upper State New York for somewhere around August 10th, around that time. And I'll open up the microphone to Bambi a little bit later, and we'll talk more about that. The third place that we're planning to do our ESM is in Tampa, Florida, and that will be toward the end of October. And Sharon Stoll is my contact person on that, so what I'll do is I'll plan to open up the mic to her as well. But right now I'd like to get this information. So Jennifer Tucker was planning to do her internship, and I have Patricia Dewey was going to take the ESM. Amanda Otish is planning to do both, ESM and internship. And Beth Brown, the same. So it doesn't look like we're going to have too much of a problem here with numbers. We also have some finishing students, and then we also have some prep students who would like to take the ESM. While I'm at it, let me open up the mic to Bambi. And Bambi, could you give me any thoughts that you might have right now on August? You have the mic.
Yes, I would love to host a Northeast conference in August. It would be a wonderful time to be in the Northeast, and I have lots of thoughts. A friend of mine does conferences. She works for a doctor's office, and so I sent her a quick email last week, and she came up with a couple places. There's a spa in Skaney Atlas. It's about an hour away from my home, but it's a little on the expensive side to stay there. The other thought is right here in Oneida, there's a very unique building, and it's the Oneida Community, which is where the Oneida Stainless Steel and Oneida Silver came from originally. And it was a utopian society back in the late 1800s. I am looking into seeing if we could maybe rent 5 rooms. People still reside in this big building, but they keep 9 rooms. I'm looking into seeing if we can use that facility. They have a great room that's literally a small auditorium with a stage, which would be great for meeting And there's also some B&Bs around here in the area that perhaps people could stay at and some other inexpensive hotels. There's also Country Inn Suites, which is about 10, 15 minutes away from me, and that might be a good opportunity for us to meet there, and maybe we could, you know, have the comfort of suite-style rooming. Looking into those things.
Wonderful. Thank you, Bambi. Just to let people know that the place that we met for the ESM in Iowa is likely not to be available this year, and that's why we're looking now at the New York area. So with this information, I think what I will do next is I'll open the mic to Sharon Stoll and have her talk a little bit about the ESM that will be happening in Tampa and what her thoughts are on that. Then after that, I'm going to ask people to push either number 3 if they want to consider New York, or number 4 if they want to consider Tampa, or number 5 if they'll probably do one or the other, but they don't know which one. So let's open up the mic to Sharon right now. Sharon?
Good evening, everybody. Well, I just wanted to say that it would be wonderful to have people come here to Tampa to study, and we're about, I would say, 15 or 20 minutes from the airport, so it would not be a huge travel, it wouldn't be a lot of travel difficulty for people, and Tampa is a very good airport to easy access in and out of, and everything is within 15 or 20 minutes. And I have several ideas for locations, and I haven't honed in on any particular one yet. There are several excellent conference sites with hotels or motel type facilities that would be excellent and would be fairly reasonably priced. And there are hotels or restaurants nearby. And so I think this is an excellent location to host EFM or ESM. So I'm looking forward to it, and I'll let you know as time goes on just how it unfolds. We have some time yet. It's not till the end of October.
Right. We're looking tentatively at this point at the week starting of October 26th, going into the beginning of November. So those are the dates that Sharon is looking at this point. So what I'd like to do right now is I'd like you to press number 3 if you'd like to consider, if you think you're going to consider the New York, Upper State New York. It's over going toward Syracuse, Buffalo area. Bambi, where would they fly into?
They would fly into Syracuse International Airport. Oneida is about 35 minutes from the airport. It's an easy ride. We can arrange for people to be picked up. So it's a fairly inexpensive. Southwest does not come into there, but there's many airlines that do. So it's Syracuse International Airport.
Great. Thank you. So press number 3 if you're thinking of Upper State New York. Press number 4 if you're thinking of Tampa. Press number 5 if you're not sure, but you think you're going to do one or the other, and I'll get that information. Either or for Kim Valentine, either or for Jean Gerda, either or for Martha Painter, either or for Trish Weaver, Darlene Walton Ford, Robin Bruce for number 4, Florida, and Jan Brookhart is either or. Oh, Jennifer Nikowski is either or. So if I did not call your name, that means I don't see anything next to your name. And send me an email if you're considering San Diego, New York, Florida. Okay. Okay, folks. So that's the news on that end. We'll keep in touch with all of these developments. I will take any questions and comments now before I start the lecture going for today.
Hi. I was just wondering, because I'm starting on the Celtic Circle, and when I'm going in between the modes and I have to do lever changes, with which hand would you recommend doing that with?
Definitely with the left hand. And what I would do is only do a chord and just do one lever change. Do another chord, do another lever change. Don't try to do them all at the same time, because then there's a big gap between the song and the improvisation. All of a sudden everything falls out because your left hand is being active, changing the levers. So you
okay.
just do at a time, and you give yourself as long as you need. When we do it as a group, usually I give you 8 chords to try to get your 3 or 4 levers up. And when you're doing it on your own, you can take as long as you need to get into that aeolian. The thing to watch out for is that you want to stay away from the note that you're changing, because check the sound before you get into the aeolian. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. At this point, I would like to actually get started with our presentation today. And I would like to introduce to you Jeff Volk. Jeff has been a longtime friend, actually, going way back into the 1980s, actually maybe the 1970s. I'm not sure about that, Jeff. By the way, Jeff, you have
to go back that far, Tina.
You don't go back that far. Okay, neither do I. I'm only 39, right? Okay, sometime in the 80s, I know that Jeff was putting together, I believe it was the first Sound Colloquium, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was in 1993.
Oh, well, gosh, maybe I'm thinking ancient these days.
That's 20 years ago, so.
But the first Sound Colloquium was in, is it Epping, New Hampshire? Epping, New Hampshire?
Epping.
New Hampshire. And it was just really marvelous. We just had everybody there who was doing work in sound and healing and wonderful, wonderful speakers, of whom many of these people have gone on a whole career in sound and healing. And Jeff put this all together. He also has compiled a lot of work from Hans Jenny that he's going to talk about today, and done a lot of research on cymatics. And the lesson that you've been looking at this month is covering some of that work. And this is really the premise for the International Heart Therapy Program. That's what makes our program different than a lot of the other programs. We just don't learn songs to go in and play by the bedside. We really understand what it is that we are learning and how those sound vibrations work sympathetically and help amplify what's going on. And I'm sure Jeff will talk a little bit about that. So, Jeff, it's a real pleasure to have you on. I'm going to turn it over to you and give you the next hour here to do your lecture, and then he's going to be asking some questions or feedback along the way. And what I'll do is I'll jump in and give the mic to different people. So, Jeff, it's all yours.
Thank you, Tina. Yeah, this is great. Actually, I know a few of you anyway have a background in cymatics. I know Jeannie, we met at the Harp Therapy Conference in 04. I just checked my notes when I found out you were online. And I know a few other people also know a bit more about this than just, you know, having, well, how much of it did you actually study this week? What did that entail for this lesson?
I put some of the clips from your website up on on their lesson plan. Don Campbell was also featured on this lesson, as well as Ani Williams and
some of the clips from your website feature other people like John Bolio.
Yes, yes.
In some of those clips.
Oh, good. So if people have seen that, then you really do have a visual of what I'm going to be talking about, because this kind of a presentation goes much better with visuals than it does with me just talking about it. But what I can certainly focus on is some of the principles that are illustrated through cymatics. But I should assume, or I can safely assume, that everyone listening has a rudimentary understanding of what cymatics is?
Yes, yes. I think after this lesson that they've looked at, they have a basic understanding.
Good. So they would all understand that the term cymatics is a term that was coined by Hans Jenny in the late 50s and throughout the 60s, coming from the Greek kima, around waves, about waves. And cymatics is a study of wave phenomena and vibration. It's actually a study in physics, of phenomenology. Jenny was an anthroposophist, a follower of Rudolf Steiner. So he tended to approach science from the Goethean perspective, the perspective of Wolfgang Goethe, who had a philosophy that was much more organic than what science has devolved into, which is, you know, really a materialistic approach to try and create concepts around very limited observations. Goethe was much more of a mystic, and he observed nature and tried to derive principles from his observations. So it's a much more holistic approach towards science, but it also involved the scientific methodology of phenomenology, which is what Jenny excelled in. Jenny was a medical doctor, and he was also the village physician at Dornach. He was the village, what do you call people who take care of animals? He was always hands-on, both with patients and with the cows and the chickens in the village there. He was the village veterinarian. He was sort of a wandering veterinarian. He'd take his walks in the morning and visit all the local farms. So he was constantly interacting with the natural world and constantly reinforcing that mode of perception, which was nonlinear. It was multifaceted. And the style of science that he practiced was phenomenological, which meant that you repeat an observation over and over again and see what you can derive from it. So it's deducing and inducing from observations of nature rather than coming at it with a concept and disregarding most of your data so you can prove your point, which is what a lot of science, especially if it's funded by, you know, the pharmaceutical industry or any other vested interest, the oil industry, you know, science has become something very devoid from our daily activities, and that is something that really is a shame, because it is just a way of objectifying a subjective experience. And if you can objectify a subjective experience, you can then share it with people at a level of principle, concept, and eventually an approximation of truth. Whereas subjective reality, it's 100% true because it's our reality, but it's not necessarily a shared reality. So that's the beauty of this type of science. And when I show my presentations, I love to show some of Jenny's artwork, because his artwork focused on animals. I've imported this amazing book from Switzerland, which was all about the animal portraits that he did. And it's called Tierlandschaften, Animal Landscapes. And in the ones that I show in my slideshows when I give these presentations live, they focus on the animals as almost condensations of vibration within nature. So if you've seen some of those videos, you recognize that cymatics is a study of standing waves, or another way of looking at it is acoustic resonance. So resonance is a principle, it's a function of nature that allows vibrations to be transduced from one element to another and to create an experience in the other element. So in a sense, I am I'm an acoustic resonator right now. I'm talking into a microphone, going through this whole network of wired and wireless technologies, and coming out to you, and you are resonating to some degree with what I'm saying. So right now it's kind of abstract, but it will get much more plausible as we go along. So hopefully you're resonating with this stuff. I guess what fascinates me about cymatics is the fact that it makes the invisible visible. And when I show the slideshows, I show one particular slide of an owl, which is totally dark blue against a dark blue background, and the eyes are orange. They just jump off the page. And I say, what was Yeni doing? He was making the invisible visible. Because 90% of our sensory input comes in through the eyes. 90% of our sensory input is processed through the ears. And that includes the cochlea and the balance and our orientation in space and all of our felt sense that is through that sense of perception within the middle ear. But also all the subconscious sounds that we process that give ourselves not only orientation in space, but orientation through memory and through collective history and through primordial sound. So any type of a loud, quick bang is going to interact with your nervous system immediately. It goes right into the parasympathetic or into the sympathetic and tightens everything up. So this is a process that does not require any thought. It's hardwired into our anatomy as a survival mechanism. So much of our sound perception and balance and orientation in space is subconscious. So it's interesting to note about 90% of our cognitive input comes through our eyes. So, you know, we don't read with our ears. We read to understand with our eyes. So the fact that Yeni was able to show the vibrational coherence and the geometric patterning that's created through something as amorphous and subjective and unconscious as sound was really quite amazing, because it opened up another way of cognizing around sound, and it also allowed for many of the principles of what sound and vibration lie to become more aware to us, more relevant and pertinent to our conscious minds. So this was very, very important work. Now, cymatics can be applied in a lot of different ways. There's the whole therapeutic branch of cymatics called cymotherapy or cymatic therapy that was pioneered by Peter Guy Manners in the 50s and 60s. That has been brought much more to the fore these days through the work of Mandara Cromwell and her associates through Cyma International. They produce an annual conference on cymatics, primarily on the therapeutic aspect of cymatics down in Atlanta. I believe next year's conference will be in October or November of 2013, and it's definitely something to check out. It's an amazing field that has very direct application to music therapy and sound therapies. I mean, it is a sound therapy.
Can I get information about that all from your website?
Yeah, it will be posted on our website, and I don't have that information up there yet, but do check back cymaticsource.com, cymaticsource with just one S in the middle. We'll post activities that I'm involved in and the cymatics conference. I think there are so many different ways to approach this. You know, there's the actual physics of cymatics, which is fascinating, and it is something that has direct implication to the work you're doing. But there's also the more abstract principles that are demonstrated by cymatics. So I'm assuming that people will have seen the video clip of Christian Stuten blowing in, or not actually blowing, but singing into the tonoscope, the little plastic device, and making those beautiful patterns on the membrane that stretched across the bell of this essential little plastic saxophone. Am I safe to assume that everyone has seen that?
I'm not sure if that was one of the clips, Jeff, or not. I think it was.
Okay. Well, he said some really interesting things in that. And some of them have profound implications for our entire way of viewing the world. One of them was that the more complicated, the higher the frequency, the higher the pitch of the note that he sang in to this membrane, given all other factors being equal, the more complicated the form is going to be. So this is something that I find very fascinating, because in our world, the frequency is rising rapidly. Everything about our world is increasing. It's increasingly hectic. It's increasingly complex. We're increasingly bombarded with more and more diverse kinds of electronic impulses, cell phones, Wi-Fi, RF frequencies, cosmic frequencies, you name it, we're getting hit with it. So things are speeding up. And this can lead to a significant amount of neurological overload, but it also gives us an opportunity for transforming through chaos. And if you know anything about chaos theory, there is a four-stage process of buildup of energy. And in this process, you tend to get overwhelmed. And when overwhelm gets to a certain point, which it does with all of us, you know, we either shut down and go unconscious, or we get sick, or we get way stressed out and tighten up and contract. In one sense or another, the system shuts down or breaks down, and it ceases to become a coherent, viable system. But the other outcome of that is that the system is free to evolve to a higher, more resilient and functional level, with actually a newer and greater ability to dissipate this entropy. So we're talking about an open system here, a system that is not confined. So basically any system that is organic is an open system, because it exists in the environment and atmosphere and ecosystem, which is semi-permeable. You know, we always interact with something that responds to us and we respond to it. So what we see here, and in a very direct way, let's take a look at the crisis or the calamity that just happened a couple of days ago with the shooting in the school. You know, we tend to think of things fairly statically, and that things tend to stay in, well, a body in motion tends to stay in motion, right? So the structures that we've built, the established constructs that we operate within, we assume are constant. And every once in a while, something comes up which shows us that they are not constant. We have an economic crash. We have the pedophile, you know, revelations of the entire church structure, which is a massive shaking up of the premise of some of these archaic structures of control that have been in place for thousands of years. We have things like, you know, indiscriminate, senseless shootings of children or, you know, people who we call victims. You know, there is no sense for this. It breaks down this sense of safety and control that we operate within. So this is seemingly a calamity or a catastrophe, but whenever these things happen, they're shaken up for a reason. They're shaken up because the structures are no longer viable. They no longer can sustain the vibration that is behind what is happening in the world these days. And that's not saying that schools are going to become obsolete, or the church is going to crumble, or, you know, our economic system is going to be no longer. I mean, maybe that will happen in a couple of days when we move through the termination of the Mayan calendar. But I tend to believe it's a much more gradual evolutionary process. And this is one thing that cymatics shows so beautifully, again, in a more symbolic way. An interpretation of the physics of cymatics can show that when there's sufficient stress on a system, it will evolve to a higher order of complexity and coherency. Now, not always. If there is not a coherent tone behind that frequency, it can dissipate into chaos and entropy, and things fall apart. But the beauty is we exist in a larger field, and that field is inherently coherent. there is no way that a universe could be sustained, or let's put it this way, there's no way that a human culture could be sustained on a planet that could be sustained in a solar system, that can be sustained in a universe, that could be sustained in a larger cosmos, without some sort of coherent controlling order. Call it what you will, that's irrelevant. But it is an organizing force, nonetheless. That organizing force is seen at many levels. In fact, it's seen at infinite levels up and down the scale of creation. Jenny had a beautiful, and by the way, Hans Jenny is pronounced Jenny because he was Swiss. The J is pronounced as a Y. Jenny had a beautiful statement that once one's eye is open to the cymatic phenomena, you can see it everywhere. And Jenny was a good one to say this because he was a polymath. He was a real Renaissance man. He studied, well, being a medical doctor, obviously he studied the physical sciences. He'd studied embryology and biology, cetology. He'd studied the earth sciences, orology, the way vibrations and pulsations move through the earth, obviously the way pulsations move through water. He studied meteorology. He studied astrology. And notice that this basic cymatic principle, as well as history and biography and the social sciences, that there is an underlying oscillation or pulsation that permeates everything. Let's take a look at a personal biography. You go through phases. Everyone goes through the first 7 years of growing up, essentially the same phases, unless you have some sort of let's put it this way. There is a large regularity of people moving through that process. Everyone goes through it individually at their own speed. But overall, there are cycles of seven throughout the life where you develop physically, you develop emotionally, you develop mentally, and you develop spiritually over seven-year cycles. So these are oscillations that ongo at a regular cyclical rate. And again, there's individual variation to this, but this is the essentially the matrix or the pattern of development in human beings. And obviously, not everyone makes it. I mean, not all humans are created equal. We don't all go through all those phases. Some people never get out of the emotional band. A lot of people never get out of the emotional band, never develop mental capacity to discern and articulate and control their behavior. They're just ruled by their emotions. And this is not just women, mind you, of which there are probably 95% on this call, so I better watch myself.
Things I was thinking of is that the work that Rudolf Steiner did in the Steiner education is based on the seven-year cycles.
Absolutely. And Jenny and Lauterwasser has taken Jenny's work into the 21st century, much as Mandara has done with Peter Guy Manner's work in cymatherapy. Both of these men have strong backgrounds in anthroposophy, Rudolf Steiner's work. In fact, that little clip I was referring to back in the beginning of the tonoscope being demonstrated by Christian Stuten, who incidentally was Jenny's original assistant doing all that work. He was the one who took most of the pictures in the cymatics book and did a lot of the filming. I actually interviewed him back in early 1990, I believe. Probably 92, something like that. This was at the repository for where Steiner's work was in the Goetheanum in Dornach, Switzerland. That little device that he was blowing into, singing into, the tonoscope, the plastic acoustic tonoscope, was actually developed for the anthroposophic schools, the Waldorf schools. Now, here's a question to you. This is something that people should be able to figure out. Knowing that anthroposophy and Waldorf schools dealt with people with different types of physiological or neurological impairments, they excelled at educating people who had different types of difficulties or handicaps, if you want to use that word. What type of group do you think might be most helped by something that would make this invisible power of the voice visible to you? Anyone can answer that.
Anybody would like to answer that? Press number one on their keypad.
Yeah, it's not a trick question. Think about making the voice visible and how that might help a particular population of impaired people.
Well, we have a very shy group here. I think, here we go. Kelly Johnson, you have the mic.
Well, you know, if it were made visible, then for the hearing impaired, if they could observe and see these speech patterns, then it seems like that would be one of the groups that might be helped.
Absolutely. Absolutely perfect. You hit it right on the head. Yeah, you hit it right on the eardrum. For people who can't articulate their vowels, for instance, to have a teacher be able to show you visibly the difference between and and be able to see those patterns articulated as each vowel is stated. You know, the deaf person could put their hand on your chest when you're making those sounds and watch your mouth and tell you, say, I'm making an ooh sound, like choo-choo. And then the person who couldn't hear would be able to use that same device and play around with it until they got the right shape. Once they got the right shape, this is a biofeedback device. They know that they were creating the right sound. So these little toys were used as educational tools for the hearing impaired and deaf students who couldn't speak. So very good, thank you. So that was just one practical application of cymatics. There are many, many, many practical applications. One interesting, I'm just sort of scooting through my notes to see what might be best to cover here, because there are so many different ways we could go here.
Jeff, one of the things I just want to bring home, when you asked if they'd seen the membrane, yes, they did see that. I was thinking in terms of the plate, which also shows it, as well as the membrane. That is, when you see that in action, you see those beautiful patterns, but in the midst of getting from one pattern to another pattern is where everything goes into chaos. And that is what Jeff is talking about. In order to get from one beautiful pattern on the membrane or the plate to another, there's this whole period of chaos that happens. So I just wanted to clarify that they did see that.
Oh, good. And thank you for bringing that out, because that is actually a crucial point, and one of the more important principles that cymatics demonstrates. It doesn't just demonstrate, well, in Lauterwasser's book, Lauterwasser is a German researcher. He is contemporary. He's working now. And he has done a lot of research on Jenny's work and bringing it into just a much higher level of refinement. He's using, you know, digital technology that has precise controls, sine wave generators that are, you know, precisely frequency controlled. He's a third generation photographer, so he can really document his work well. And he's just using equipment that's 60 years newer than what Jenny had to play with. You know, Jenny was in the very cutting edge of this work. So Lauterwasser, in 2005, I published his book called Water Sound Images in English. He wrote the book in German. And I took particular care. I actually worked with the text for a year to make it into something that Americans would tolerate, rather than being something that's coming from a German philosopher, which he is. And, you know, we just don't like to work that hard. So without dumbing it down, I softened it a little bit to just make it easier to read and more user-friendly. And that book, Water Sound Images, focuses largely on Lauterwasser's work, obviously with water, but even more with creating analogs, visual analogs of nature forms, forms found in nature. And he created a total analog of a tortoise shell. It looks exactly like the patterns you would see on a tortoise shell, which is a very intricate pattern, by resonating sand or lycopodium on a steel plate. You know, I can't imagine how much time it must have taken him to do that. But he was able to do that. Leopard spots, zebra stripes, similar structures to the skeletal systems in sea creatures, you know, just really complex structures. And, of course, all the beautiful geometric structures that underlie the formations and the layout of flowers and seed patterns and the growth of trees and different types of plants. They all adhere to certain geometric patterns, basic patterns, the hexagonal is being one of the more prevalent ones. But the pentagonal is also very prevalent in nature, and the quadrate pattern. So, you know, Lauterwasser took off on what Jenny did in exploring how these patterns relate to nature and then reproducing them. And the book Water, Sound, Images is absolutely phenomenally beautiful. It is one of the nicest documentations of this I've ever seen. And we also have some video of his work as well. So again, the books focus on the structural element, and as Tina said, the films will avail you to perceive the dynamic flux in which this is all happening, because nothing is static. You cannot step into the same river twice, said Paracelsus, I think it was, or Heraclitus, I forget who, but you know, everything is always in movement. The most solid things are oscillating. They are always vibrating. And this is not just a theoretical concept. This is the way it is. The fact of the matter is, there is no matter. In fact, an effect of this on-again, off-again world makes it appear as if I were here, speaking to you as if we were two. When indeed it appears that between our four ears there is really only one I, that we each are a part of, yet linked at the heart of the ineffable, and who's to say why? But through this complex and hypnotic illusion, we've steeped ourselves deeply in convincing confusion. So the truth remains hidden, plainly in sight, as if we'd forbidden ourselves to feel right about being uniquely both one and the same. We each are the other, just with a new name. No matter. So, everything is vibrating. It's always oscillating. It's always in motion. And one of the things that Jenny showed in his experiments was that in a perturbed environment, an environment that had external perturbations imposed upon it, which could be seen as chaos, there was a heightened sensitivity to reconfiguring at a higher order of complexity and coherency. So when things were static, there is no impetus to change. But if you put in an external impulse, like anything that I've described earlier that shakes up the system, there's the potential there. Well, the system starts to break apart. The structure, the stability of the system starts to break apart. And, you know, we're very familiar with this. We experience this a lot in our lives, personally. And when it does, we feel like the world's coming to an end. I mean, our mind will take a snapshot of that and compare it to some past tragedy and calamity that it has stored in the recesses of its subconscious. And it will tell us, oh, no, this is happening again. The world's coming to an end. And that is the way we immediately contract and resist what is yearning to come through us at a higher level. And now if you remember that clip that from Of Sound, Mind, and Body, Music and Vibrational Healing, that featured John Beaulieu, the beautiful statement he said about when you resist something, you're separating yourself from it, you're holding yourself from it. He was talking about sounds and noise and stuff, but this is true with anything. You've created a resistance. You've pulled yourself away from it, and you're using energy to try and keep something from happening. Well, that is a form of constriction, closing down, and shutting yourself off from the pulsations that are seeking to evolve you, me, everyone, to a more inclusive and coherent state of being. So, you know, one of the best things we can do for ourselves in terms of our own personal and spiritual growth is to breathe and just be open when something comes that feels like an affront. You know, someone, let's say there's an emotional assault, you know, you have a blowout with your kids or your partner or something. You know, can we perceive that as a pulsation coming to shake up some of our limited thoughts and feelings about ourselves ultimately? You know, things that we believe about ourselves, our limited self-concept, that we are not allowing life to infuse with its vibration. Can we breathe into this perfectly crafted dilemma, which we've composed as the symphony of our lives, so perfectly orchestrated for our own execution? You know, can we do that? If we can, then these vibrations become something that enhances our lives instead of something that attacks our being. And that is one of the most profound principles that can be derived from cymatics, because it's extremely personal. It is totally subjective. And it is demonstrable through physics that this is the way things work. As outside, so inside. Okay? It's the same principle operating at all levels. So I guess I've been going all over the place here for the last half hour. I'm just wanting to get a little bit of feedback from Tina and anyone else who's on the call as to any areas that you'd like me to focus on, because there is a lot that I would like to focus on. And one thing that I do want to bring up is this little clip from Sarah Jane Williams' beautiful harp therapy DVD on psychoneuroimmunology and how sound impulses actually affect our neurology, which to me is just the same thing as cymatics. It is a different permutation of the same thing. So why don't we see how people are doing with this, where we're tracking, and if we're ready for that, I can just go to that little clip. You won't be able to see it, but you know, there's not so much to see anyway. What's more important is to be able to hear the clip, and I will be able to show that to you, or you know, pull that through the phone for you. So,
okay.
So let's take some questions.
Okay. So as people are thinking about what Jeff has just talked about and wanting to make a comment or ask a question, press number one on your keypad. And I will just mention at this point that Barb Crow's book that is on the required reading list, Music and Soul Making, she goes into a lot about the science of acoustics and sound vibrations. And the very last chapter, she talks about chaos theory. And she's actually been on sabbatical writing another book, an extension of that. Just to let you folks know, she has said that you only need to report on the first two chapters and the last chapter in that book, because the middle of it is very technical. So I did want, and now we have some people with questions. I'm going to open it up first to Sherry McHale. Sherry, you have the mic for a question.
Hi, thank you very much for being with us today, Jeff. I have a different kind of a question. You know the picture of the leopard spots and how they were able to come up with a pattern? Anybody doing any work with this with crop circles to see if there's any communication from out there?
You know, Freddie Silva is Mr. Crop Circle, so he would be the one to ask about that. I know Freddie, and we talk about this a lot. He definitely feels that the geometric patterns created in crop circles are a form of cymatics. In fact, the way I met Freddie many, many years ago was he licensed cymatics images from me to include in his book, his first book, Secrets in the Fields. So
oh, cool.
I know that he feels that there is an electromagnetic pulsation and essentially sound encoding into those pulsations that create the crop circles. Yes, great question.
Thanks. I'll have to look him up.
Yeah, Freddie Silva, S-I-L-V-A, very easy to find. He's just put out a new book, too, so you can find him all over the place.
All right. Well, thanks for addressing my question. I was a little bit hesitant because I know it's a little bit out there, but I thought, well, what the heck, might as well ask.
Hey, listen, everything's out there.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
That was a wonderful question, Sherry. Jeff, just a couple days ago, I came across a lecture, and I believe the person's name was Penny Androff, and he was talking about the crop circles as well, decoding the crop circles. Are you familiar with his work?
A-N-D-R-O-S, Andros?
I think that it was really an amazing lecture, which we didn't finish, and I'm looking forward to it. But he sounds like a person that really has this all together. So I will send everybody, I'll find that lecture again and send that information to you, Jeff, and to the class, okay?
Okay, great, great.
I'd like to open up the mic right now to Denise from Cyprus. Denise, you have a question or a comment?
Yes, I have a question. I'm really excited to meet with you, Jeff, and hi. And then I'm trying to endeavor to understand about the cymatics. Cymatics is beautiful symmetry of nature, I understand that. And then there are many beautiful and impressive shapes of frequencies which have really effect on our bodies. And the harp has wide range of frequencies. But what is the common point between cymatics and harp, and how we can integrate both? The answer is frequency or vibration, isn't it?
I was just going to rephrase that for you, Jeff. She was wondering how we can use the harp to work with these vibrations.
She's created the perfect segue for me to show that video clip.
Okay, and we have a couple other questions. Shall we go into the video clip first?
Yeah, let's just do the clip first, and then I will be happy to take those other questions. Or, I mean, we could do it either way. It makes no difference.
Let's do the video clip since it pertains to exactly what we're doing with the harp.
Okay, here it's coming up now.
Audio clip, rather.
Yeah, it'll be an audio clip. This is from Sarah Jane Williams.
According to the latest research in the field of psychoneuroimmunology, receptors in the cells of the body are activated by specific frequencies and their higher harmonics.
Okay, did you get that? That was a lot for a first sentence. Psychoneurology, it talks about how the effects of external stimuli affect our nervous system. So they're perceived either usually through the senses, but they can be cognitively perceived as well. It's psychoneuroimmunology. It's the way things affect our psyche. So it can even be memories. It can be an actual physical occurrence. It can be music. It can be inaudible frequencies. All of those things affect our neurology, okay? So I'm going to go back, and we're going to play that first sentence over again and keep going, okay? Did it sound okay? Does it sound good?
It came through fine.
Okay, fine. Okay, I'm going to start it over again so we get to hear that sentence again.
According to the latest research in the field of psychoneuroimmunology, receptors in the cells of the body are activated by specific frequencies and their higher harmonics.
Okay, we really need to understand this. Receptors in the cells in the bodies are activated by frequencies. So this is the mechanics of the way we perceive. And this is so exciting. When Yeni did his experiments, what he did was he used crystal oscillators to act as transducers between the frequencies and the steel plate. And here our cells are doing the same thing. So there's an electronic impulse that goes through the wire, it goes into the crystal, it gets the plate vibrating very strongly, and the plate starts to resonate through sympathetic resonance, and the sand that's spread on the surface of the plate starts to create coherent patterns when the tone is sustained for long enough. With this particular thing, we have electrical impulses moving into the cells being generated by our senses, by the impulse that's happening by pulsations coming in to our sensory mechanisms, and that's the way it's transduced. So I'm going to play that sentence again so we can see it in that context and then let it run. It's a very short clip. It's only a minute, but there's so much fundamental neurological and biology here that it's very profound statements that are made here. So let's just listen once more time.
According to the latest research in the field of psychoneuroimmunology, receptors in the cells of the body are activated by specific frequencies and their higher harmonics. These frequencies, which fall within the audible sound range, affect cellular activity in the same way that peptides, drugs, or emotions would.
Molecules located throughout the body communicate with each other through resonance. through a psychosomatic network of cellular communication and through a matrix of collagenous fibers. When pressure or vibration is applied to the human body, the signal is transduced to an electrical charge, which can vibrate receptors where emotionally charged memories are stored. This model accounts for high-speed information transfer over and above the synaptic firings of nerve endings.
So there's no way you can catch everything that was said in just that one little minute. There was an incredible amount of very valuable information there. But basically, if I'm to transduce what was just stated there, that the cells are working to transduce electrical impulses, which are essentially pressure waves that affect our different sensory input systems, whether it's the eye, the ear, the system of touch. They're all dealing with oscillations. They're all dealing with fluctuating pressure fields, which they then transduce into electrical current, which then goes through our nervous system and gets interpreted by the cells of the body to give us access to memory, as they were talking before, that you have a somatic memory of everything that's ever happened in your life and in your past lives, if you believe in them, that can be activated through sound. So, you know, does that, I can't say answer your question, but does that give you something to think about in terms of your question?
It certainly does. One of the things that happens when we play the harp for somebody and we find that resonant tone is that we're making that connection, that we feel that amplification coming off from their body. And that's when we go into that whole state of inclusive attention, which many of you will be studying in your experiential specialty module, the ESM. And this is the work that Susan Borg did in the resonant kinesiology program. And this is where a lot of the work that we do in the IHTP stems from. And when I took that two-year course with Susan, Jeff knew Susan quite well, we would actually experience sound vibrations going into different parts of our body. So we would have different tones that would actually be projected in the room. And she didn't say that it was going to affect a certain part of the body. We experienced it for our own selves, because everybody has a different water component in their body, or a liquid component, and a body mass weight. And so it may be a different tone for somebody who was much bigger than maybe a newborn baby. But in general, when those tones were projected, you could actually feel the vibration in maybe your leg bone or in femur, or you could feel it in the nervous system in your head. And those particular frequencies would sympathetically vibrate another part of the body. And one of the things that was a big question for me at the time was, what happens if you're playing for somebody and you actually have that tone that is vibrating, let's say, the liver, and somebody has cancer of the liver? Are you moving something and causing more cancer to spread, or are you containing it? And that's where all the work of intention comes into our work, that we're not just playing sound vibrations and putting them out there, but when we're working with each individual patient or client or person, we're holding that container with the intention. So that's the other very, very profound part of our work. And I can tell you, and most of the people who have come to San Diego Hospice and they've seen myself and others work with resonant tone, you don't want to wear a lot of heavy clothing because you get very, very hot. It's almost like the same concept of doing Reiki. You get very, very hot when you're actually working sympathetically with another person. And that's why in our work, less is more on the harp. If you're playing lots of notes, there's so much vibration going around that sometimes maybe a whole session will just be two or three notes. Would you like to pick up on any of that, Jeff?
Mm, Yeah, it's fascinating, Tina. Thank you. Thank you for elaborating that. Yeah, it's funny. The first thing that came to mind with me is, you know, the clinical application of sound, whether it be vibrotactile through the harp, like Sarah Jane is doing, or whether it be cymotherapy, which is not even having, essentially the practitioner is not in the picture. It is an instrument putting in just the vibrational frequencies for specific, you know, commutations of frequencies for specific applications. So in that case, especially the latter case that I just described, their intention is not really a strong power there. It is strictly the vibration working with the tissue and the subtle energy of the vibration working with the subtle energy body. So, you know, there are so many levels to address this on, because I do not want to diminish the importance of intention and the human component and the emotional resonance that goes on there. That is profoundly important in any type of therapeutic practice, because really any type of disease is a manifestation of a feeling of isolation. It's a feeling of non-inclusion. It's a feeling of being unloved and shut down. And I don't say that as a way of blaming anyone for anything. We all have these feelings. It's inherent in our makeup. In the lower body chakras, we operate off of fear of survival instinct and this terrible feeling of aloneness and separateness and the anger that results from that. Those are the bottom three chakras. The elimination chakra has the fear, and the reproductive has that feeling of aloneness and separateness, which is why reproduction is such a dynamic force in the world. And the navel chakra harbors that anger of that separation and fear. Because they have not been, they're still operating from the separate egoic sense of survival and of the world being an assault on them. So they have not been spiritualized yet. And most of the world operates from those lower three chakras, if they've even gotten that far. So, you know, that's what rules the world, is fear, aloneness, and anger. You see that acted out all over the place. And, you know, that is the core of what happened in Newtown just a week ago, is this poor distorted soul was running around totally, totally dominated by those feelings and had nothing to do but act out in an aggressive and self-destructive and destructive to everyone else way. So, you know, these are some of the things that we're dealing with that we don't have a clue about. These are the underlying psychodynamics of illness, and not only illness, but our personalities. You know, this is what shapes our personalities. If you've ever really observed someone, you notice that it doesn't take much to get them to behave like an adolescent, revert right back to that stage of amygdala response over frontal cortex. And if you've ever been able to observe yourself in retrospect, you realize that it's true of oneself as well. Then the most evolved people can revert to this animal tendency very quickly if there's not a constant state of awareness and actually a higher vibration, a conscious intent to attune to a higher vibration. So that's where I see attention and intention as being so powerful, in not only the therapeutic process, but in a process that would even put us in a space where we can be a therapeutic force, as opposed to being a further aggravation or a further intimidating force, another force that proves that underlying psychodynamic of I'm not good enough and the world's out to get me, which we all walk around with deep within us in our shadow.
Thank you, Jeff. Should we take a couple more questions at this point?
I think we better, because that was like way out there.
There were a couple questions, and for some reason the raised hand that I have here disappeared. So if anybody has a question, please press number one on your keypad. And while we're doing that, we'll take a comment or a question from Jean Martin.
Oh, hi. That was brilliant, and I really needed to hear that right now. Perfect timing. But I just have a really basic question. You had said in the beginning 90% of cognitive input comes through our eyes, and then 90% of another input comes through the ears. And what was that?
Yeah, that's our sensory input as a whole. That includes the two systems of the ear, you know, the perception of sound and our component that gives us the balance and orientation in space. They're two totally different systems, but that does comprise a lot, as Tomatis talked about quite a bit, the vestibular system. I might have said cochlear earlier. In fact, I did. Mm-hmm. What I meant was the vestibular system, which provides our balance and our orientation in space.
Oh, right.
It's a large part of that sensory input, because that is really what allows us to be embodied. It allows us to be somatically aware, is the vestibular system. The cochlear system processes sound, but it also it charges the brain, so it's a lot more than just processing sound. In terms of hearing, it has to do with charging our nervous system, as Tomato showed. So between those two functions, and again, 90%, who knows, you know, because there's no way of measuring. But it is clear, I mean, scientists have measured these things, and God knows how they come up with these figures, but it's pretty well accepted that between the vestibular and the cochlear function, a large amount of our sensory input is processed through those systems, and most of that is totally unconscious.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And Tina, thank you for the reminders as well about resonant tone, which for me is really... kind of challenging to work with if I understand it correctly. But anyway, thank you both so much.
And tone is a challenge for a lot of people at the beginning, and it certainly was for me after I took the resident kinesiology program with Susan Borg. I was like, what is everybody hearing here? I don't hear it. And it really took me about 2 years to feel comfortable. And then it just all clicked one day, that sense of the amplification between you and another person. And the way, you know, you find resonant tone at the beginning is you know when you don't have it. There is no connection whatsoever. I mean, if you're just playing something and the other person's staring around in space and there's no connection, it's no aha moment. You know that something's just not resonating with them. It's like getting up and getting into your car. This morning I had the radio on from last night, and they took that beautiful song, how does it go? The Carol of the Bells, dum-da-da-dum, and they've rocked, turned it into a heavy metal rock type thing. And all of a sudden it was just like, turn this off. It's really bad. It didn't resonate with me. And sometimes when you're playing for somebody on the harp and all of a sudden you just get this disconnect with another person, it just shows you that you've got to change your whole way of playing, possibly the key of music. Not possibly, definitely the key of music. And we start out by learning how to improvise in the key of C with the different modes, but that's where we need to then go into the different keys of music. And not only are we looking for that particular harmonizing note, but what is the mood of a person? What is the mode that we're going to be playing in? So that's all the different things that you're going to be learning in the ESM. And prior to that, it's just really, really important that you understand your theory as far as what notes comprise what key of music, and to be able to do it quickly. You know, three flats is E flat. Oh, my gosh. The first overtone series, or actually it's the third overtone series, would be the thirds, and therefore that's going to be a direct harmonic overtone. So understanding first your key signatures, your circle of fifths, before you come into the ESM, you're going to get so much more out of it, okay? Let's take any questions and comments right now, and then I'll have Jeff wrap up his conversation. Press number one on your keypad if you have a comment or a question.
Hey, Tina, I have a quick comment. You know, what you were talking about with having to tune in to the client in the therapeutic setting is 100% the same as what we need to do as we go through life. We need to be constantly aware, and I don't mean this in a codependent way where you're always walking on eggshells, because I know what that's like, but just be aware of the vibration that we're putting out and what we're receiving from the people around us, and be very quick to modulate. you know, if we're outshining our neighbors, you know, and they're getting uncomfortable around it, you know, it's just dull it down a little bit and meet them at their level. And vice versa, if, you know, if there's someone out there who really needs some help, you know, having the perceptual fluidity to be able to resonate and provide the comfortable surround of proper resonant frequency with them through our empathic sense, that's really what being a human being, a sentient being, is all about.
Absolutely, Jeff. And I see nobody has any comment or question right now, so I think you just said an amazing closing statement there. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we finish this call?
Yes. And it has to do with what we attune to, because what I just said had to do with how we attune to our external world. Ultimately, we cannot be effective therapeutically in our living if we're not constantly attuning to a higher vibration or a more refined vibration or a life-giving coherency, that field that is constantly animating everything and allowing for all the chaos to reintegrate and all those structures to dissolve into chaos. There is a real deep fear of chaos because we associate it with death, and for some ridiculous reason we fear death, usually because it's come at a very inopportune moment before, so you know we're not really wanting to let go at that point. And that process of death happens over and over again throughout our life, and the more comfortable we can come to accepting the process of dying through our living, less trouble we're going to have when that time comes in our life. And that doesn't mean just being able to let people close to us go in the therapeutic setting. It means letting go of beliefs, and more than even our beliefs, our self-concept, you know, who we've always dreamed ourselves to be. If we can allow that to be assaulted by the world, which it will do, that's part of the process of growing up. If you look at growing up, it's having your self-concept assaulted by external realities. That is the process of growing up. You know, if we've had a good childhood, we're brought into a very safe space, and we're continually bludgeoned as we grow up with evidence that tells us that this is not a safe place and that we have to retract and go back into the womb where it's safe. And the growth process is facing that fear. And, you know, perhaps building a thicker skin, but also opening to those assaults so that they can penetrate and prove what they need to prove, that you are actually stronger and wiser and larger than anything that you've attracted into your life as a learning experience. And I think that is really the summation of the highest principle of cymatics, that the world in which we live has not been imposed upon us, but by us through the vibration that we attune to. We send it out into the world. The world reflects it back to us.
That's really profound, Jeff. It really is. And it really takes away this whole feeling that people are victims. Lots of times, I remember there was a time in my life where I went through thinking in terms of being victimized. And as soon as I was aware of that and started changing my thinking around and understanding a greater, it was through cymatics and through faith and through prayer and through science and putting it all together, that the awareness grew and that one could make a difference in their life. That's very powerful to learn as we, like you say, grow up.
You learn it over and over and over again until we really get it.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, I want to thank you so much for being on the call today. And what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to open up the mic to everybody so that they can say thank you and goodbye. And any other announcements will come through in the form of an email to everybody. So, Jeff, thank you very much. And right now we're going to open the mic and everybody will say their cheers to you. Everybody has the mic.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Right.